welcome to this new edition of the Brother UK Cycling Podcast with me, Timothy John, where today I'm joined by my co-host, Phil Jones, the Managing Director of Brother UK. Phil, good to see you.
Hi, Tim. Yeah, great to be here.
Tell me, Phil, how are your nerves after spending a day in the Das Hutchinson Brother UK team car at the Women's Cycle Classic? Not for the faint-hearted.
No, I don't think you'd want to be a car owner particularly running that course, Tim. The cars really do take a battering on that course. And there was a few times when we had some body panels and skirting, scraping the road as we either hit potholes or just kind of drifted off of the main parkour onto the grass and sort of bounced our way back on again. So, yeah, I imagine there's quite a few cars going to need a visit to the garage after that that day's race.
Well, I'm not surprised. We're going to talk today in some detail about the Women's Cycle Classic, but I'm sure everybody by now will have seen the pictures on Fellow UK and elsewhere. The muddiest race you've ever been to, Phil?
I think so. Yeah, it was brutal. And sort of getting out the car at the end of the race, I said to Ian, actually, and Dean Downing. So Dean Downing was around supporting some of his coach riders, that you have really got to admire the bike handling skills of those riders that compete in that race. Because, some of the parkour was so churned up and muddy and slippery and at times deep that you've got to have amazing bike handling skills. You've not only got to be, of course, a really good bike rider, and have all of the attributes we would normally expect of somebody to read a race and to, to have the underlying fitness and all those sorts of things. But on this one, it's a different level because it brings a layer of bike handling in that I think only the most confident of rider could end up winning that race.
Absolutely. And we'll hear a bit later in this episode from Hope Inglis of Brother UK Team On Form. Hope has represented Great Britain as a cyclocross rider, so no surprise to see that she was the highest placed finisher for Brother UK On Form, all of those cross skills coming in handy on that unbelievably muddy course. We're also going to talk about a huge appointment, Rod Ellingworth, who can justifiably claim to have revolutionised the development of young British riders when he founded the road programmes for British Cycling's Olympic Academy. Now, Rod's had a glittering career in the UCI World Tour, winning Grand Tours as a race coach at Team Sky, later serving as general manager at Bahrain McLaren and as deputy team principal at Ineos Grenadiers. Well, now he's been appointed race director of British Cycling's Tours of Britain for Men and Women. This is a bit of genuinely exciting news, Phil. I remember you and I swapping messages on the day that this appointment was announced, and it's been rare, hasn't it, in recent years to get a bit of news that really sets the adrenaline flowing, but this has to be one of the more exciting announcements, I'd suggest.
Yeah, it's a big appointment. Clearly, Rod Ellingworth's hugely experienced, on the world tour. And, you look at that clinically and go, well, actually, does Rod have the absolute skills and competencies to be in role? Probably not. But as a name and somebody that's capable and someone that could lean into that role quickly, is he that? Yes, he is. Then you look at the wider network of people that Rod Ellingworth knows, not just nationally, but globally in the sport, and say, given the momentous challenge that British cycling have ahead, I mean, let's be honest about it. It's a massive undertaking to get these two tours organized, particularly with the women's tour so close, that you are going to need to pull on as many people and resources and favours as you possibly can. So if it were me, the first place I'd be looking is, who do I know that knows lots of people that can help in this particular set of circumstances? And I think Rod Ellingworth really fits that profile.
Well, Rod Ellingworth's contacts book must be like no other, I'd imagine. I mean, he must know everybody at the sport's highest level. And as we know, he has the health of British riders and British road racing very much in his heart. I mean, I thoroughly recommend having a read of Rod's Project Rainbow book to anybody out there who hasn't done so. It's been out a number of years now, but if you want to learn more about Rod's career, it's a great reference. The other major topic we're going to tackle today, Phil, is the proper Northern Road Race Series, organised by Cold Dark North. Brother UK will serve as prize fund sponsor, and that gets underway this Sunday, March the 31st, with the Cape and Ray Road Race. I mean, this really is a cherished series.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I've just had the race manual off of Toby and Debs, which is lovely, and it looks really professional, as you would normally expect. I think those guys always raise the game and put high standards up for themselves and want to create a great race series. So, yeah, very exciting. Let's just hope the weather holds up. Obviously, here in the Northwest, we're not known for our sunny conditions, let's put it that way. And we've had an awful lot of rain and wind recently. So it's been quite a strange weekend just gone. We've gone from, you know, one day having sort of 40 mile an hour gusts to the next day it being quite clear. So I'm genuinely hoping for all the riders that they have a clear day for the race on Sunday.
We'll talk of weather conditions, Phil, gives us a perfect lead into our news roundup and a summary of the Peaks 2 Day, a national B event held over both days of the weekend just gone. And if ever a race was affected by the weather, it was this one. Now, the women's race was supposed to open last Saturday morning with a time trial, but that was cancelled for fear of snow. The following stages of the women's race and all three stages of the open race went ahead, but sleet, hail, biting crosswinds, and yes, even sunshine, were all part of the mix. Overall victory in the women's race went to Imogen Wolf of Shibden Apex RT, hot on the heels of her triumph in the Junior Trofeo Binder. Second was Lucy Gadd of Le Col, who won the final road stage. And third overall was Morven Yeoman of Das Hutchinson Brother UK, who'd finished second on the opening stage. In the open race, Tom Martin of Wheelbase Cabtech Castelli took overall victory ahead of runner-up Damien Clayton of Le Col and third place Jacob Smith, another Wheelbase Cabtech Castelli rider. Phil, just how significant a signing is Morven Yeoman for Das Hutchinson Brother UK? You witnessed her in action at the Cycle Classic, where she finished in an impressive seventh place.
Yes, I did. And I'm not going to say that everyone was surprised that she was in the top 10. When you look at her and you look at what her, you know, physique is and her riding style, she doesn't look like your sort of traditional ruler, you know, the sort of person that would win a classic, albeit the pointy end of a classic. But clearly, she's got the power and she's got the race awareness to know where to be and to also position herself. And as a result, here she is in the top 10. So absolutely, when the radio reports were coming through into the car and we were hearing that, you know, Morven was right up there at the pointy end of the race, Ian, the team manager, wasn't actually that surprised. He knows she's a very, very capable rider. And I would say, watch out for Morven in the proper Northern Road Race series this Sunday, because I think the route, the hilliness of the route, will really suit her.
Well, let's hear a little bit from Morven now. I caught up with her soon after the Cycle Classic in the week before the Peaks 2 Day. Now, she began her season back in February when Das Hutchinson Brother UK, who'd been training in Altea on the Costa Blanca, received an invitation to the Clásica de Almería, the UCI 1.1 race with professional teams including Sarah Tizzett WNT and Human Powered Health. Let's hear now from Morven.
Yeah, so I just, as a kid, kind of got put into most sports, and my dad used to do cycling, and then my brother, who's 27, so quite a bit older than me, also took up cycling. And I think I just thought, like, my brother's really cool, so I need to do cycling as well. Like, yeah, most family holidays were, you know, we went to the tour, watched cycling, and I think I just thought, yeah, this is what I want to do. So from quite a young age, I've been cycling, probably since like 6 or 7. So I'm actually in my second year of under 23 now. I'm going to be 20 this year. The team merged in December last year. So it was Hutchison, Brother and Das Hansling. They came together. So I initially had joined Hutchison Brother in August of last year. I just seen the team. I just really liked the way that it looked like from the outside that it was run. And yeah, obviously I've known Simon as well from Das Hansling. So yeah, I couldn't think of a better place to be, really. Having other girls to ride with is really nice. Getting to know the teammates before like we go into races is really valuable. You know who you're working for, you know the strengths and weaknesses of each rider, and it just gives you a really good base to like go into races feeling confident that we can work as a team and that we can execute a plan that we've been given. We went straight down from the training camp. It was a bit of a shock, to be honest, that because we weren't actually initially meant to be doing it. So I think we'd just done about 25 hours the week before on training camp, and all of us were a bit like, oh, got a race in a week's time. But honestly, I think it was great. We didn't really have to think about it. We just went straight into it. It's a point one, so it's pretty high level. Not an easy way to start the season. But yeah, I did feel pretty confident in where my form was at, but also at the same time, had no idea how it was going to go. Luckily, I just found myself in the right position at the right time. And yeah, just managed to stay in the front group over the hill. For sure, it does give you really good confidence for the future races, knowing that if you can perform at a point one fairly well, then you can hopefully do it in other races and replicate that, if not, like, be better. And for sure, I made mistakes in that race. So, I mean, who knows what could have been the outcome if I hadn't, but I can take 19th. Like, very solidly, and be very happy with that.
So wonderful to hear that from Morven Phil. This is a young rider in a hurry and one with a very bright future ahead. As I say, or rather as she said, a top 20 finish at the Clásica de Almería is already among her early season highlights, and that is a professional race. I mean, she's performing at the very highest level.
And yeah, I think she's clearly showing maturity beyond her years. When it comes to, you know, being an out-and-out racer. You know, sometimes when somebody's got that sort of natural instinct as a racer to be able to kind of be in any race and sort of know where to be, what move to follow and all those sorts of things, then that is just a really fantastic skill set. And it looks like she looks like a real talent for the future. So I'm very excited to see where her journey ends up.
So how did your day at the Cycle Classic pan out, Phil? Did you spend any time with the teams before the race? Did you get to watch them warm up and wish them good luck?
No, not really, Tim. And I'm gonna give away a bit of a secret here, which is obviously I did go to the race. And also I was at the race many hours before the race started. But one of the things I try to do as a sponsor is basically stay out of the way. I think sometimes it can be awkward when a sponsor turns up because the riders are thinking, well, what do I need to do? Do I need to sort of entertain them? Do I need to be talking to them? And all these sorts of things. So normally when I just turn up, I just let Ian and Andy know that I was there and Mark. I just disappear. I walked into Melton Mowbray and got myself found myself an independent coffee shop, had a lovely coffee. I watched the final of the Junior Cycle Classic come in, and then I wandered back and you know, just basically kind of put myself in the pits until about 20 minutes before the race begins. So I think that gives the riders the space that they need to prepare properly. There's nothing worse than a sponsor trying to come in and take pictures or want to talk to you when you're preparing for a big race. So I guess over all the years of sponsorship, I've begun to really learn that. You know, after a race, absolutely fine. But before the race, it is not the optimal period to be chatting. It's funny who you meet, isn't it, when you're hanging around. So as I parked my car up, I was just sat in it when I got back from Melton Mowbray and just with a coffee. And a car pulled up next to me and it was Alex Dowsett.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And he was there. And so I jumped out and had a quick word with him and, you know, just said, you know, what's he up to? And he just said, well, he's obviously he'd come with one of his cameras who's creating content for his YouTube channel, but he just started to come and hand out some bottles. So he sort of planted himself on the course and was handing bottles out. And I thought, now that is absolutely brilliant. You've got, you know, a world tour professional, two-time Giro stage winner, ridden for five world tour teams, glittering career, world hour record holder, you know, former world hour record holder, and he's driven up in his boots to stand at the side of that race there and hand some bottles out. And I thought, good on you. I was really, honestly, I was so impressed. And he, you know, he wandered around the pits and he chatted to everybody, gave time to everybody. And I thought that, for me, is really, you know, giving back to the sport. So all credit to Alex Dowsett.
Well, let's get into this Cycle Classic review. It's a race billed as Britain's Belgian Classic. And my goodness, it lived up to that billing in this 8th edition of the women's race and 10th edition of the junior men's race. Previous winners include DSM Feminec PostNL's Josie Nelson, who was our guest in episode 50, and Ineos Grenadier Josh Tarling has a victory in the junior men's race on his Palmares. This year's women's race served as the opening round of the 2024 National Road Series for Women, and the conditions were some of the muddiest seen in any edition of the Cycle Classic. The junior men's race was won by Aaron Dick of UBCC, second was Milo McIntosh of the Cycling Academy, and third, Hugo Bednarek of Fencham House Mass Design, another of Giles Pickock's rising stars. The women's race was won by Aluna King of Life Plus Wahoo, second was Isla Shaw of the Alba Development Team, and third was Alice McWilliam of Hess Cycling, and our own Morven Yeoman, where she was seventh for Das Hutchinson Brother UK, as we mentioned. Phil, you were right at the heart of this race. As I mentioned earlier, we've all seen the pictures, but what was it like to be on the road?
Well, what I love and why it's such a great privilege to be in a team car is you can see a race through a totally different lens. You know, pictures are one thing, but actually when you are, you know, clattering around at sometimes 5 miles an hour, and in the next breath you're doing 55 miles an hour, you know, trying to pass a rider, it's really exhilarating. But you can also see just how everything works. You know, there was a number of things that I sort of observed during the race, which I just thought were very, very interesting. Number one was when Ian came to the pits after he'd been in the manager's briefing with the race director. My first question to him was, what's our position in the convoy? Because for me, convoy positioning, given the narrowness of the roads, was going to be crucial. And he said, we got positioned four, which is not too bad. So we're fourth back in the convoy effectively. So why is that important? Well, of course, the closer you are to the front, more likely you are going to be able to service your rider if they have an issue. And particularly given the parkour, you know, which was, you know, generally, you know, really, really horrible. You know, it was rutted roads and potholes and, you know, muddy banks and mud buildup and puddles. It screams that there's going to be technical issues of one kind or another. You know, things bouncing back up into your group set or stopping you shifting, naturally punches, or hitting a wheel and maybe breaking spokes. There's all sorts of things that can happen. So the closer you are to the front, it's more likely that you are to be able to service your rider if they're competing for, you know, to be in the top 10. But what you realise is actually those convoy positions are almost irrelevant to about the last 8 or 9K of the race, because very early on, and probably in the first 3 to 5 kilometres, riders were already getting dropped. And I said to Ian, actually, as we went out, this is a hard start because there was quite a few drags. So, that, you know, for those riders, you know, who were just getting dropped on those first few drags, literally that was already beginning to split the field. So when those riders drop back, let's say one rider got dropped, the whole convoy then has to sit behind that one drop rider. So the bunch goes riding off. And then, of course, the whole convoy is behind a single rider. And because of the narrowness of the lanes, and then also the what happened with the heavy rainfall, is it's very, very narrow. And it means, therefore, that your ability to pass is very, very restricted, very restricted. And, of course, rider safety is so key on a race like Cycle Classic. So the team managers have to be really, really careful and very, very measured about where and when they pass. Then you've got, you know, the race commissaires, the motor commissaires, you know, holding you back until they're also confident that there's a place to pass. So what that means is that the convoy itself is sort of behind all the action for a lot of the race. And your ability to get up to your riders is quite difficult because, of course, once riders start coming backwards, thankfully they're coming back in twos and threes, and you're just waiting for a time to pass them. But, of course, when you've got 12 or 15 cars, then of course you might only be called forward in two cars at a time, for example, to come into a gap, things like that. You can see then that suddenly the team managers get frustrated because, of course, they're miles away in their head. They don't know potentially how far away their group is because, of course, they're relying. There's no rider and manager radios. So you're relying on race radio then to give you race reports. And, of course, given the conditions, the frequency probably of those updates might not have been as frequent perhaps as other races that I've been in. So for a lot of the race, we weren't 100% sure who was where until you're getting an update from, you know, race radio to go, oh, and there's seven riders in a breakaway. And, oh, hang on, good news here. We've got a rider in the break. That's really good. So that's what it really, I think, was the really big insight, is that if you have a rider that has a technical and a mechanical, and we did, we actually had, Sana had a mechanical. Of course, everyone flew past us in the race convoy. And suddenly we were almost like at the back of the convoy. And so next thing you know, it's like, how do you work your way back up the convoy? It's not like a normal road race where you just, you know, you've got two lanes of a tarmac road. You are firing down a cobbled road, which is muddy and dirty and wet, and it's got grass either side of it. And somehow you've got to try and work your way back up that convoy. It takes a lot of patience.
Yeah, and cannot take any chances, Phil. Rider safety has got to be paramount.
100%. And that's what, you know, I was really observing Ian. Ian is a very experienced convoy driver. And what you realise on that race is a space to pass a rider will appear in an instant. And you have to have the confidence to know when to go and when not to go. And you need to make an immediate decision about the safety of the rider in front of you and your ability to pass. And there were many times in the race where you'd look at it and go, you could probably fit a car through there, but Ian wouldn't, because he knew two of his wheels would be on a mushy grass and two would be on the sort of the cobbled parkour, which does not mean he is in control of that vehicle. And that vehicle could make some sort of sudden movement. So there are times when that experience says, definitely not, we'll just be patient and we'll sit here for the good of that rider. There are other times when you come off of that horrible, horrible road onto a main road, and that main road might only be for half a kilometre or something. And that is exactly the point when you need to go, when you go, there's a space, and you can see the difference between perhaps really experienced drivers and perhaps those building experience, that there were times when perhaps a more experienced driver might have gone shot past a group and a less experienced driver did not. And as a result, it meant all of the convoy might have been held up. So these are the small differences. These are the nuances that I think you get to see when you're in a race. And I think it's really, really interesting when you see that actually the way that these drivers are qualified and trained, it's so important for rider safety. It really is so important. And you've only got to look at the number of marshals that were on the course, the amount of safety measures that Colin had put in, you know, the barriers, obviously the bubble, everything. You know, it's so well organized. And literally, unless there was somebody directing you, I would have absolutely no idea of the course direction. I mean, it literally was, we were sort of turn a left, go down a lane, come back, and then we'd be coming back the same lane the other way. And it's like, wow, I mean, how we designed that course is incredible.
Almost a standing joke, isn't it, among Colin and his volunteers, that only a handful of them know the parkour at the start of any edition of the Cycle Classic. Another area, Phil, in which you're able to provide a lot of insight is neutral service. Of course, we sponsored neutral service for over a decade. And the chap who used to manage that on behalf of Brother UK, Tony Barry, is still running things. Did you manage to get a word with Tony, Phil? How was the race from a neutral service perspective?
Yeah, I saw Tony very briefly between the end of the junior and the beginning of the women's, and sort of wound the window down and said, Tony, how are you getting on? And you've been busy. And he said, yeah, I've changed about six wheels on course in the juniors. And actually, a very interesting insight for me, Tim, was the number of bikes with rim brakes in the Junior Cycle Classic. And it just goes to show that actually, you know, you don't need a top of the range, fully carbon disc brake bike to race competitively. You know, there was as many rim brake bikes as there were disc brake bikes in the Junior Cycle Classic. And, you know, that was always the discussion that Tony and I would be having all the time is, what is the optimal combination of wheels that you need to carry on the roof? And for an event like that, you know, it's everything. It's rim, Shimano, rim, Campag, rim, SRAM, as well as disc versions of all the above, which I thought was really fascinating. And obviously it creates a massive challenge for neutral service on the day.
Yeah, I mean, it's good to hear that youngsters are not being held back by budget or anything like that. They're just getting out there and racing regardless of the machinery. And that, of course, is what it's all about. Did you get to see many of the Das Hutchinson Brother UK riders, many of the Brother UK on-form riders, Phil? Or once you're in the race, is it a constantly shifting picture?
Honest answer is, I think we saw one or two of our riders, and that would only be perhaps if they got dropped, you know, that we sort of shot past them trying to get back up to the front. Again, it's the nature of the race that effectively, I think it's so unique because of the fact there's no radios, there's no way to communicate with them. You might come down to a lane, and if it's one of your riders, you see someone at the side of the road and you go, oh, it's one of ours, quick, what do we do? So it's just how it is, because the race gets split up so quickly and it splinters so much. There's riders everywhere. And Ian kept making me laugh because he's just going, it's absolute carnage. It's carnage, but it's carnage quickly. It's not like it rolls out in a procession and yeah, it does 50K and then it becomes carnage. It's like carnage after about 5K. It's unbelievable. It really does split up. You know that because of the way that you're passing riders, you know, little groups of two or three all the time, just getting dropped out and dropped out and dropped out. We're riding in the cars through places like the Summerburg, you know, all the crowds are there and all the bells are going and everything, and it's absolutely brilliant. But you then begin to see where the gaps are appearing in the race.
Well, I was going to ask about the atmosphere around the course. I mean, that's at least 50% of this claim to being Britain's Belgian Classic. It's not just about the racing, it's about the atmosphere, about how it inspires people just to come out and enjoy bike racing. Sounds like you saw plenty of that on the Summerburg field and presumably in Melton town centre as well.
Yes, obviously I walked into Melton Mowbray, as I mentioned earlier, to have a coffee, and yeah, there was plenty of people out to support the race, which I thought was absolutely brilliant. Maybe that's a byproduct of it being run for so many years, which is absolutely great. My biggest disappointment was I could not find an open pork pie shop in order to bring back my own Melton Mowbray pork pie.
Well, that is the second tale of pork pie-related disappointment that we've had on this podcast, because Josie Nelson, you might remember, told us that she'd promised her dad that if she won, she'd bring back the giant pork pie, only to discover that it was the prize for the sprints competition and not for winning the race. The good news, though, is that he has forgiven her since, so a tale with a happy ending. Interesting, Phil, to hear you describe how the race splits up, and I caught up with Mark Botley, the manager of Team Brother UK on form, who knows more about the Cycle Classic even than his fellow DSs, because he grew up in that part of the world and still lives in that part of the world. He's competed in the race. You know, what Mark doesn't know about the Cycle Classic, frankly, isn't worth knowing, and he made the point that the gravel sectors are only part of the story.
The thing is that those off-road sectors, for me, they're not the defining part of the course. The defining part of the course is just generally the up and down, that 5 mile loop around Burr on the Hill. There's no flat on it. It is up and down. The roads were in particularly poor condition this year, so there were a few kind of punctures, and you know, I didn't see anybody crash, but I would be amazed if nobody did crash in that. You know, basically the race is still together after about 12 miles. And then 5 miles later, after they've gone around that loop, it's all over the countryside. They focus on these kind of off-road sectors because they're ridiculously muddy and everybody's there with the cameras and everything. But I think actually nobody, you might get the odd person get a little bit dropped or something, but generally wherever you are in the race at the start of that sector, that's where you are at the end of the sector. Summerburg's slightly different because it is a little bit longer, but it's that attritional 5 mile sector on really poor road surface, and it's just up and down. And to me, that's what this race is all about. That's the hard part of the race. Yes, I think if you are like Hope and you've got excellent bike riding skills, and then you're going to have an advantage. There's no doubt about that on the Summerberg. But if you're not at that level that you can kind of keep up there, having, you know, on that 5 mile sector, it doesn't matter how good your cyclocross skills are, because you're going to be out of the race. First year they did that race, I can remember going to watch it, and there was basically 60 riders all together as they went out of Burr on the Hill, out of Alston, to do that 5 mile circuit. And 5 miles later, there were some people who were 4 or 5 minutes behind, and it was completely shredded. So to me, that 5 mile sector, which they do 3 times or in total throughout the whole race, that I think is by far the hardest part. But yes, the eye-catching thing is obviously the sectors, and they were particularly muddy, I must admit.
So wonderful to hear there from Mark, and a very interesting perspective, Phil, that for all the talk about gravel sectors and mud, the tarmac areas of the course can be the most decisive.
Yes, what surprised me was the course actually is very rolling when it gets onto the, you know, onto the tarmac. You think it's just going to be, oh, just pan flat rolling around the lanes, but actually there are some good drags in there that will allow somebody that's a punchy climber to really put some time into people. So, you know, it isn't just about your bike handling in the lanes that will determine the outcome of this race. It's your overall ability as a bike rider, of course it is, plus amazing bike handling skills on the day. The other question I was asking actually just before we rolled out was, you know, tyre pressures, what's everyone doing? What tyre widths are people using? What tyre pressures are you using? And obviously everyone is going quite low on the tyre pressures, and many are running sort of 28 and 30 mil tyres effectively, so they don't get caught in any of the gaps effectively in between some of the cobbles effectively, which are in some of the lanes.
Did any of the riders give an insight into the type of tyres they were using, Phil? Tubeless now, I guess, is the default setting for this race?
Yeah, most people were using tubeless that I could see. You know, all the riders that I spoke to and seeing what are using, they're like, yeah, we're all on tubeless. For a race like that, and I think because of this issue about getting the support, then that's probably about, you know, about de-risking probably the best option that you're going to take on the day.
Well, let's conclude this review of the Women's Cycle Classic by hearing again from Morven Yeoman, the highest placed finisher from Brother UK's sponsored teams. Not bad for a rider who, as we'll hear, is looking forward to hillier races.
Yeah, it was an interesting day out. Very brutal, just not necessarily because the pace was super high all the time, just the sectors, the mud, your brain is constantly going, you're using so much energy thinking about the race and what's to come, and yeah, just being in the position all the time, it takes so much energy out of you. But yeah, it was a grippy day out, and I managed to make the front bunch. I think it was of about 15 going into the last lap, and then a few dropped down. And then, yeah, to be honest, I didn't really have much left for the sprint. But yeah, gave it my all. I kind of knew that it was going to split just purely because of how hard the sectors were, how muddy they were, how many potholes there were. So I knew that I needed to be positioned well all the time in the race, because it could have gone at 10k, could have gone at 80k. But I think it just naturally split. And then Hess had quite a few riders in the front group, and they were just drilling it and keeping the pace high. So then I just kind of knew, yeah, I'm in the right place here. And I think it's going to be difficult for people behind to get back on. I was really happy. It's my best national series finish ever to date. So yeah, I couldn't really like be happier. But obviously, athlete, I'm fighting for the win. So it would have been cool to be there or to be on the podium. But you can't do everything all at once. So yeah, no, I definitely think I can hold my head high. It's a good start in the national series. So on a course that for myself isn't particularly my kind of course, prefer some hillier terrain. So I think it can only hopefully go up from here. East Cleveland is coming up, East Cleveland Classic. And then, yeah, Rydale and Lancaster are definitely two in the future that I would be looking forward to. And I think we're doing maybe Tour de Féminin in May. So that would hopefully be a good race for me as well. And yeah, just more hillier, harder races, what I like.
Now, another rider who doesn't lack bike handling skills is Hope Inglis, who we mentioned earlier. She's a Team GB cyclocross rider. She's ridden in rounds of the UCI World Cup. but that's only part of Hope's story. She's also a computer science student at Birmingham University. She's a degree apprentice with PricewaterhouseCooper. She's the youngest member, and I think the youngest ever member, of British Cycling's Road Commission, who once held a face-to-face meeting with British Cycling's last CEO, Brian Facer, to argue for more resources for women's cycling. So Hope is a force on and off the bike. Let's have a listen now to Hope.
This year, I started at University of Birmingham to study computer science. So that's been pretty busy because it's been colliding with the cross season quite a bit. But yeah, definitely enjoying it so far. It's definitely tough balancing the uni with the cycling. Basically, I'm doing a degree apprenticeship with PwC. And so I'll be working for them in the summer and in my third year on a placement. And yeah, I think definitely the cycling, well, it definitely helped me get the job because I have a lot on my CV about cycling. I think it definitely has taught me a lot, especially time management, always balancing the school with the training. So I think definitely it has helped me overall. I've always taken an interest in campaigning for gender equality in cycling. So that actually started as an under 12 when I noticed that my local league race on the circuit racing wasn't very equal between the girls and the boys, and the boys had a lot more opportunities than the girls did. And the style of racing that they were experiencing was very different to the girls, mostly due to there not being that many other girls in nearby going to the races. So my Go Ride club coach at the time suggested that instead of complaining to her, I write to the CEO of BC. And I think she was joking, but definitely didn't take it as a joke. And so I did. And since then, I've just carried on growing up, as I would always notice when the national circuit series, the girls' races would often be less long than the boys, or they'd get less prize money for the same race, and that always annoyed me. And so I would always try and talk to the race organisers about that, but then I was realising that it would just keep happening. So talked to a lot of people in British Cycling, and yeah, since then, just sort of as I've moved into the women's, noticed more and more problems and tried to think of ways that they can be changed. And so basically joining the Road Commission's been part of that, in that I really want to bring the rider voice to the table and help make those decisions. I think a lot of things are moving in the right direction, but then it's by no means easy, and definitely there's still a long way to go. And other things are, I think, moving in the wrong direction. For example, the junior national series that used to just be juniors is now under 23s as well, which I think is a shame and perhaps indicative of the fact that we still do need to make sure we're fighting to improve the racing scene in the UK for women. And I think until it's at least equal to the men in the number we've got, we've definitely still got more to go and more riders that we can be encouraging to race and ride.
So wonderful to hear that from Hope Inglisville, as we say, not just a rider, but a member of British Cycling's Road Commission. She's going great guns at university. She's a pretty keen example, I would have thought, of everything that Brother UK is trying to achieve with its sponsorship of grassroots cycle sport.
100%. It's sort of part of the reason that we do this is, you know, we talked before, it's not just about the logo on jerseys. It's about, you know, creating platforms for people's potential. Many of the people who race domestically, and we know this actually from the work we did on the Elite Task Force, you know, addressing some of the issues in the road racing scene, was that in the survey that we did, we know that about half the riders, you know, who ride domestically are not riding to become professionals. They're riding because it's their hobby, I guess. It's what they like to do outside of work in their spare time. And I guess, you know, for somebody like Hope, as you just described there, you know, she's a career professional, clearly very intelligent computer science student. She's in PwC. So she's got, looks like a, you know, a glittering professional services career ahead of her. And at the same time, she wants to competitively race. and is also looking to make sure that her, you know, that the environment that not only she but others race within is the best it can be. I think that's great. And that's the sort of individual that we hope ends up in some of the teams that we sponsor, because it just gives them that then platform to do that sort of stuff and to race competitively and to have the right kit and bike and contribution towards race fees, all of those sorts of things. That's what financial sponsorships help towards. So, you know, 100%, I'm really encouraged by what Hope is doing.
Yeah, absolutely. The kind of young person that any major business would be looking to take on, I'd imagine, somebody with that skill set. We talk a lot, don't we, when we're discussing the Rayner Foundation, that they're not actually trying to produce professional cyclists so much as very grounded, very resilient, very resourceful young people. And I guess Brother UK is doing something similar with its team sponsorships.
As an employer, when sometimes we have people coming for interviews and we look at their CVs and career histories, we're also interested on who they are outside of what is their identity outside of their professional, chosen professional subject matter. And when somebody competes in sport at this sort of level, you already know that they have got discipline, a work ethic. They are more often than not a team player. They are used to sort of rules and regulations, which obviously in corporate life we have an awful lot of. So they tend to fit very, very well into a corporate environment. So, you know, back to your point, yes, when we have individuals like Hope, I think in any company anywhere where somebody is competing at a very, very high level in their spare time, it generally brings a very, very strong candidate to your door.
Yeah, I mean, that's an extremely good point. And to bring the conversation full circle, let's hear now from Hope's mum, Claire Inglis. Now, Claire has two daughters who ride for Brother UK Team On Form. The other is Hope's elder sister, Ellen, who's a student at Loughborough University. And Claire believes that cycling has played a significant role in her daughter's achievements off the bike. Let's have a listen now to Claire.
I think the most important thing is to make sure they're having fun and they feel able to go off and enjoy it, taking all the hassles away. So making sure kit's ready and cleaned and waiting for them, making sure that food and drink is there when they need it and is what they want to eat, and getting them to the start line happy, ready and happy. That's all we ask for. We've just had to learn as we go along all the way. As the girls have got more passionate about the sport, we've had to work it out and ask for advice and get help. And luckily, cycling people are really friendly and they do help you. People are usually generous with their time and their experience. And we've taken advantage of that a lot in getting advice and help. We hadn't got any idea about cyclocross until Hope, it was her go ride coach, suggested she might like it. And so we started off going along to a couple of training sessions. Then she tried a local race and one thing and another. And it's the help and the welcome from that community that have really kept us going. And we've made friends along the way. You know, you see the same people at races week in, week out. And it is a community, and it's fun to be part of that. A little bit less now, Hope's at university. We don't take her to the local league races, but it used to be pretty much every weekend through the winter for one thing or another. And then, well, yeah, pretty much every weekend, I think, is what I'm trying to say. I think sport has brought them an awful lot of opportunities that at the beginning I would not have anticipated. I think it's made them more confident people, more resilient. I think they have had better success at school because they have had to manage their time better. They're much more disciplined young people. They're so passionate and focused that they're able to get the job done when they need to, so that they can get on with their training and their cycling. I think it's brought them all sorts of opportunities to meet different people, to travel to different places. We've been all around the country, and I don't imagine we would have done that without cycling. And now we're starting to venture that bit further afield as well. And we wouldn't have done those things, and they wouldn't have done those things without sport. It does add up. The kit and the gear, that's not cheap. Race weekends, there's a lot of extra bits and bobs. Yeah, it adds up. I don't think I want to think about how much it adds up to. The team support, race entry being paid, things like like that, it really helps. Every little bit helps. Hope's had some help, an award from the Pedal Club in the last year. People have helped her with bits and bobs, more than bits and bobs maybe, but someone from the Pedal Club gave her a frame and then she bought some of the other bits for the bike and basically taught her to build a bike in the summer. Again, that's a marvellous experience that she finished her exams and then went to meet someone and built a bike for herself to race on, and she raced on it in the circuit series. And that goes back to, you know, the opportunities and the learning and the experiences that they've had, and also people's generosity to help in their time and resources. And it helps, it makes a difference, it keeps us on the road. I used to look at people going to races. I mean, they started when they were really young. Hope started circuit racing at under eight. And I used to look at all the teenagers and just think they were all crazy, all the gear and the warming up on the rollers. But we're them and more now. And I never imagined my life would change like that and go in that direction. But it's been an absolute joy to go through that. So enjoy it, I suppose, is the most important thing, because it is really good fun. It's sometimes a little bit mad and scary, but it's fun overall. And just go with the flow, really, and see where it takes you.
Well, great to hear that from Claire Inglesfield. She readily admits that she and her husband Malcolm didn't know a lot about cycling until their daughters took it up, but they found a very supportive and very generous community.
Yes, it was interesting, Tim, because while I was sat in the car park just, you know, observing what was happening in the pits, I was there early, maybe 2 or 3 hours before the race. And as a result, you began to see an empty car park begin to fill. And what I thought actually then was how good cycling is for wider areas of the economy. So I looked at the number of VW transporter, you know, vans that were turning up, loads of vans, you know, loads of cars with bike racks, and everyone was wandering around in, you know, long coats. And I just thought, this is just great. This shows you what this sport does for the wider economy. But then I began to see people greet each other. A car would turn up and then somebody would say hello, and, you know, people would connect and have a hug and have a quick, how are you? And all these sorts of things. And you could see the community, a cycling community built of people like Claire and her husband and other parents who are really genuinely supporting the sport. They are part of the fabric of the entire sport. So we talked a lot, you know, in the task force about, you know, the importance of volunteers, the importance of the commissaires, the importance of the organisers. But as important are also these parents and partners who are supporting their children or siblings or boyfriends or girlfriends to race. And they're all important because it costs money. You know, it costs money to get to places, so petrol, and sometimes there's overnight stays and all of these sorts of things. So it's not easy. And you do need a sort of a support structure around you in order that you can race. And without that support structure, I think it's really difficult.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Mark Botley, Phil, gave me a very clear indication about the value to Brother UK Team On Form of parental support. Let's have a very quick listen now to Mark.
They're just so supportive all the time, you know, and I think they're so grateful that they see our team as the right place for their children to be in a completely supportive network. Because you've got to bear in mind, they've come from, you know, kind of club teams, like youth club teams, and they're into this scary world of racing with the senior women. And some, I mean, not only are they quite obviously bigger people, but they are very, very strong. And, you know, they've been going to these races where they're all in the gazebo with all the other youths, and it's all, you know, it's kind of like racing with mates as youths. And then all of a sudden it gets a little bit more serious. But when you've got a team like ourselves that are just so supportive, and I think the obviously you've got Tafauti and you've got Liv and you've got Shibden, but they are basically junior teams, whereas we have under 23s and seniors. And Maddie Gammons is a classic example of somebody who has joined the team this year. Now, she didn't race at the weekend due to personal reasons, and that's absolutely fine. But she was more than happy to kind of come along on the Saturday and do the recce with the girls and pass that kind of wisdom on to the girls. This is what's so great about the team, because it's the juniors are going to learn from the older, more experienced riders. And I don't think any of the seniors, the under 23s, are put out by having juniors in there, because, you know, they're happy to kind of pass things on. And actually having the juniors there racing they've probably gotten looking over their shoulders, thinking, look at these juniors coming up. They are really seriously good, So it keeps everybody on their toes. But I just think it's great for the juniors because they've got these people that have done these races, like Hope, for example. She can kind of pass a bit of wisdom on. One of the things I said to the riders in the briefing was, you have to be on it the whole time. And I said, the sooner you're at the front, near the front of the race, the better. And they literally just followed Hope onto the start line. And we had about four riders on the front row at the start line because that's what Hope does. And Hope just kind of took them with her. And it's that kind of willingness to kind of learn and be all together and all in it together. It is a team effort. It really is. And I think what's great about our team, I can talk about our team, but I would say most teams are exactly the same. All the parents, they're not just looking out for their girls. They're looking out for everybody. That's what's so great about the team.
So a really valuable insight there from Mark, Phil, about this community aspect, that no one out there is focused entirely on their own riders. They're interested in making sure that everybody has a good day.
It was very interesting to me when I was in the car, actually with Ian, that he could name almost every rider on the road as we were going around. He would know almost every rider on the road. And if a rider looked like they were having any difficulty or might need a technical, he was prepared to help. And I thought that was very admirable. And I thought that's really, really good, because that signals we don't want to see any rider really suffer as a result of perhaps not having a support car, for example, like ourselves, or if their car's miles back and they genuinely are in the race. I think if you said to Ian, if that rider was genuinely in the race and needed a wheel, and their car was miles back, would he have given them a wheel? I think he would. I don't think he would drive past a rider and leave them there if he felt they could be competitive. And I thought that was genuinely a real big difference, perhaps, of where sport at this national level and perhaps sport at World Tour might be. World Tour, you just go, oh, leave them. But at this level, I think every manager knows probably at some point in somebody's future, that rider might be on your team. And people remember those things, don't they? People remember sometimes the small things. We will say at our place, the small things are the big things. The small moments end up being the big moments. So pay attention to those. So whilst, of course, racing is about competitiveness, of course it is, it's also about, I think, participation and community. And you get a great sense of that if you do go to the pits at any of these races.
Well, someone else who will perhaps have to rely on the support of an entire cycling community is Rod Ellingworth, who, as we mentioned at the top of the episode, has been appointed race director for the Tours of Britain. Now, whether this is a golden opportunity or a poison chalice, only time will tell. But the facts are that the four-stage Tour of Britain women begins on June the 6th, just over 10 weeks' time, and the eight-stage Tour of Britain starts on September the 1st. So about 5 months' time. I mean, these races are coming up fast. Rod, as we mentioned earlier, has enjoyed a glittering career as a coach and team manager, but these will be his first engagements as a race director. And I discussed the challenges, Phil, with Peter Harrison, who has been organising bike races for nearly half a century. He's the race director of the Beaumont Trophy, of the Curlew Cup. He's the man behind the Cyclone Festival of Cycling, a multi-day event with sporties for amateurs as well as professional races. He's organised national championships. I mean, you name it, he's done it. Let's have a listen now to Peter.
I've been putting on races. I've probably put on over 400 over a 48-year period, and I'm still learning. It is a very complex situation and a very complex thing to do. Initially, I thought, yes, a good appointment. Having said that, I mean, Rod's, that I'm aware of anyway, and I've known Rod a long time, that he's never put on any events, any, certainly any major events. So I think he's definitely got a big challenge ahead of him, which I'm sure he's up to with the job that he's had in previously with teams. But I do think that he's got a challenge. But I'm sure British Cycling have pulled an experienced team behind him. I know that Jonathan Day and the likes of Andy Hawes are in there already. But there are definite challenges for him. I mean, looking at the timescale involved, particularly for the women's tour, we're talking about local elections in May. Not talking about, they are going to be in May. And whether councils change, I mean, we're looking at the opinion polls at the moment, and we know that some councils that have been certainly conservative held are going to fall by the wayside. Then whether new councils will then decide a change in direction with regards budgets, etc., particularly with cutbacks and social services and everything else. And I'm sure that discussions have been going on, but of course, we are talking about a relatively, well, not relative, we are talking about a very short timescale to pull something like this off, to actually get those councils and to get those venues in place. Accommodation is one of these things that you've got to look at. Let's take the women's tour to begin with. Maybe 100 riders, there or thereabout, with support staff and everyone else. You're looking at certainly well over 200 rooms per night. If we look at just things such as, and I know it can be turned around fairly quickly, but signage, getting the infrastructure, you know, you're talking about everything from gantries to communications, getting the police involved. I no doubt Duncan Street will be using the Central Escort Group, but police normally need to be booked up months in advance because of the shifts and the rotas, etc. I would estimate that even at the women's tour, a four-day tour, you're going to be looking at least 24 police motorbikes, apart from accredited marshals, and of course, all the volunteers. We're now talking about a general election from what they're talking about in October. So that's just after what would be the mains tour. Councils could well be focusing on other things at the time. It is a big ask, to be quite frank. I wouldn't like to be in Rod's shoes. Well, in some ways, I mean, I'd love the challenge. I always love a challenge. But I wouldn't like it such a short period of time to be in his shoes unless he's got that backup that we don't know behind him.
So there was Peter Harrison, Phil, and who knows more about organising bike races than he does. He outlined a whole series of challenges, and the one that really stuck out for me was local elections. Now, councils play a key role in elections, don't they? And organising a public ballot will be just one of the things they have to think about in May, only a few weeks before the Women's Tour of Britain.
Yes, it's one of those things that most people don't think about. You know, you just think, oh, we want to get the Women's Tour of Britain on, we want the Tour of Britain on, and it surely should just be easy, shouldn't it? You know, you just go and run the race, and it's like there are so many, not just financial, but operational and political hurdles to overcome. And one of the key stakeholders in all of this are councils, because of road closures, because of, you know, all the various permissions that you need to roll a race across county after county after county. And this is where having a team around you is going to matter a lot. So, for example, look, we've got Andy Hawes there. You know, who doesn't know about overcoming those issues? Andy Hawes is the right man for the job. Obviously, he was existing route director for the Tour of Britain. So he's very, very accomplished in doing those things and getting those things over the line. However, timing is everything. And there's nothing that councils are more interested in than getting re-elected. You are so far down the priority list when it comes to anything. And obviously they go through this period of what they call purdah as well, where they can't do stuff and can't talk about things. And of course, you don't even know whether the leaders of the council are going to be the same leaders in the future. And you could have a council change of leadership, which might mean you have somebody that's less supportive of the agenda for walking and cycling and all this stuff. So it's really crucial. So I think what we might well see here is that there will be favoured councils and relationships which might be safe seats that have been known to have hosted stages in the past, which are going to be likely bankers for routes in the future. So what might this mean? It might mean stages are all over the place. It might mean that. It might mean, you know, the transfers are massive. It might mean that, because they're going to have to go to places where they know they're going to get support. Or it could be the Tour of Britain could be very tight, i.e. focused in just one area of the country where they've got a number of clustered councils where they know they can get agreement. And perhaps a good example could be like the Greater Manchester Combined Authority is the overarching authority for 10 local councils. So if you knock on their door, you've got one voice to speak to for 10 councils, which is going to be a lot easier than speaking to all the other councils. So I'm not saying that's the answer, by the way. I'm just trying to give this as an example. So my view would be is for us as the racing fans to just probably give BC the benefit of the doubt for 2024. We just need to give them some breathing space and they'll put on whatever they can put on, given the timescales that they have. And it might not be what we've been used to. It might not be. And I think we've got to just accept that. Obviously, they've got a little bit more time for the Tour of Britain. But for the women's tour, then clearly, you know, that is under a huge amount of pressure. So much to organise, honestly, huge amount. So I would go, don't be surprised if we just see a repeat of stages that have already been run in the past, literally kilometre for kilometre, from point A to point B, that they just go back to what's been done in the past. And Andy doesn't go driving all over the country, but says, there to there, there to there, there to there, there to there. There's the route. We've already done all the planning. All we got to do is pull all the detail out from when we last did it, have a word with the council. If they're prepared to do it, it's an easy win. You're not having to sort of build it from the ground up. So for me, it's like I'm expecting, my own view would be probably a repeat of past stages from previous editions. And it might be either everywhere or highly concentrated in one part of the country, even though it might be called the Tour of Britain. And we're just going to have to put up with that for 2024.
Let's move on now to races that are definitely going ahead in a form that we know and love. And those are the races of the proper Northern Road Race series organised by Cold Dark North. Now, this is a three-race series in the Northwest. It begins this Sunday, March the 31st, with the Cape and Ray Road Race, followed by the Ufton Road Race on April the 21st, and concluding with the Oakenclough Road Race on May the 26th. Previous round winners include Jack Rukin Gray, now a neo-pro with EF Education Easy Post, who won Ufton in 2022, and Kat Ferguson, who was the young British star last season and who will join Movistar team in August. She won both Cape and Ray and Ufton in 2023. Brother UK will serve this year's proper Northern Road Race series as prize fund sponsor. And when I spoke to Cold Dark North co-founder Toby Cummins, he said that could make all the difference in attracting entrants to the series.
I think it's hugely important. I mean, we tend to vary. So again, because we're not a business that's trying to make, you know, financial returns on the races that we run and the events that we put on, the sponsors are really important because they help us to make the events and the races appealing to the most important people involved, which are the racers, you know. So we have, aside from Brother, we also have financial sponsorship from Wheelbase. And then we have prize sponsors, a brewery called Fell Brewery, who are based in the Northwest, and a local coffee company called Carrington's. And those guys are brilliant because they give us physical assets, you know, they give us product to be able to give to the racers. So, you know, I couldn't tell you, you'd have to ask an elite racer whether or not the difference between, you know, first place being several hundred pounds and £1,000 is actually realistically going to sway whether or not their calendar takes them to Cape and Ray or Belgium. I don't know the answer to that question, but I do know that if we didn't have any prize money, we would lose quite a lot of riders. And I certainly know that if we didn't have some prize money and some really cool prizes that we can give out, you know, we still give a combativity prize, even though these are one day single races. We still have a King of the Mountains, Queen of the Mountains category, you know, and the prizes that we get from Fell and from Carrington's, and then the financial prizes that we get from our other sponsors make, you know, they make a huge difference, I think. And it's really nice to be able to send people away with, you know, with a nice envelope with some cash in it, but also some other bits and bobs that, you know, make them feel like they've had a day out. I mean, it sounds horribly patronising. I don't mean it to sound like that, but, you know, it does. I think it does make a difference. And actually, sorry, Tim, the other thing is that because we've now brought the three races that we're running under one envelope, we can, you know, we can do a team prize and we can do a series prize. And so the scope of prizes that we're able to give is massively enhanced by having cash sponsors and prize sponsors. You know, we can make a team prize really worth winning our entries for Copenhagen close in 24 hours time. So I'm at the stage where I'm chasing as many director sportives as I can to say, you've only got two riders in, why don't you put a third rider in? Because there's a team prize to be having, you know. And that conversation is a lot easier when you've got prizes that are worth winning.
So there was Toby Cummins of Cold Dark North, an organisation with an already well-established reputation for putting on high-quality races. And Tobes, I should say, was very keen to make the point that it's Deb who leads on Cold Dark North's racing activities. Now, this proper Northern Road Race series feel, it really has gained cherished status in a comparatively short period of time. You're up in the Northwest. What's its reputation up there? I mean, how valuable, how important is it to the health of domestic road racing in the Northwest?
Yeah, it's really key. And anybody that's met either Toby or Debs, you just know they're just really lovely, honest people that love riding their bikes. And they just, you know, said, okay, we need races. We'll organise some races. And off they went. And here we are now with a 3 road race series with prize money and an awful lot of fun. And, you know, they really, really do think about a lot of the small details. And that's why you know, put a little bit of money in, because it's just run really, really well. And they're passionate. They're doing it for all the right reasons. And what they want to do is have a really, really good mini series that people can get excited about and put some prize money on the table. And a little bit of prize money, it changes the game a bit, doesn't it? It's like, oh, prize money, you know, it makes it a little bit more competitive when people know there's a little bit of money on the table. So, you know, all credit to them both. I think it's a terrific series, which is why we're supporting it. And again, just a public health warning again, if you ever get invited to ride a bike with Deborah John, don't go. She is a machine. And never, ever try and keep up with her on a climb, because you will be dropped.
Well, you have been warned, listeners. If you receive an invitation to hit the road with Deb, then turn it down, unless you're a formidable climber. But just what we're talking about, Deb, Phil, she raised a couple of really important issues, and I wondered if they'd come onto your radar while you were working with British Cycling's Elite Road Racing Task Force. The first is a change to payment of race entry fees. It stems from regulatory changes that British Cycling, like many organisations, has had to adopt, but which has changed the point at which money is taken from the bank accounts of riders. Let's get more detail from Deb.
Money is taken from the riders' accounts at the point of entry, not at the point of acceptance, which is how it used to be. So people could enter the race early, and then money would only go out of their account if they were accepted. Otherwise, no money was taken. And it's changed to now, money goes out of the account when they enter and is only refunded if they're not accepted. So that's had a bit of a knock-on effect to entries, as you could understand at this time when money is quite tight. Then it's difficult for people to enter a lot of events, or even 3 or 4, and the money be taken out of your account before you're even accepted into that. So apparently it's because there's some regulatory necessity for it. I don't know. I don't know about those kinds of things. But I do think it has had a knock-on effect, and it hasn't been particularly well communicated to organisers, because people do ask about money. Can I have a refund? And I've always said, oh, it's not taken out until this time. So I would at least like to be able to tell people what's actually happening. That was quite a big one, and one that I think will have a knock-on effect, not for necessarily big teams, national A's, because the money doesn't necessarily come out of their account, but definitely for national B's and down it will.
So good to hear from Deb there, Phil, on a really important issue, and not just for race organisers, riders, particularly privateers who don't enjoy, you know, the support of a team and they're responsible for their own entries, they can face a significant dent in their monthly finances if they're suddenly having to pay for multiple race entries at one go. Now, British Cycling tell us that this is the result of what is effectively a change to banking regulations, something called the Strong Customer Authentication Protocol, which was introduced in September 2022, and BC briefed all race license holders at the time it was introduced. Now, was this discussed by the task force, Phil?
Yes, it did. It was raised a number of times, actually, not only by race organisers, but riders too, because, you know, what you're looking at here is this difficulty that race organisers, they need entries, they need people to be declaring interest quite a long way out before they start organising a race. No one wants to be in a position where they're, you know, a week out and they haven't got enough entries to run the race. And what they're saying is not everybody has got loads of spare cash. A lot of people who are racing at the weekends are, you know, living from week to week and working out whether they can race the next weekend or not. So if suddenly you, you know, you want to plan your schedule and you've got 8, 9, 10 races to enter, it's a lot of money because you, you know, you could be looking at £300-400. So we did discuss this, and that's certainly been put down as a sort of a recommendation to sort of like, you've got to go away and look at that, because I think it can be an issue. And it might be stopping people entering when they might have the intention, but they just can't afford to enter it a little bit further out, which then means the organisers not getting the heads up that they're intending to come. And kind of the whole thing, sort of all the walls start pressurising in, don't they? Because then the organiser panics and says, I haven't got enough entries. And everyone's like, well, hang on, I'm coming. It's like, okay, so we need somehow to work that out better, I think.
Now, the other big issue Deb raised, Phil, is the challenge of date setting. Like most things in bike racing, the date on which a race is held has a whole host of interdependencies, from booking village halls as race HQs to booking trained medics. But let's hear again now from Deb.
I just wanted to make a plea. Date setting meetings, it's virtually impossible. We have such a blah, blah, blah system. It would be so great if the national A's, everybody could choose their dates by November, like a proper date and a standby date, so that we had some kind of paper to work off as national A's, national B's, etc., etc. Because at the moment, the information just comes in such a bitty way. I've had to change my date 3 times this year because other dates have come in for races in the national A series, etc., that have just required them to change. And these are under 23s and various things. So date setting is something that really needs to be gotten right.
So another very interesting point there from Deb, this time about the system for getting dates onto the calendar. And I think from Deb's perspective, Phil, as an organiser of National B races, she's hanging on the National A's. Once they've got their preferred dates, that's when she gets a chance to consolidate dates for her National B events. Again, was that something that was discussed by the task force?
It was. And you know, the planning of the entire season was sort of one of the big discussion points that kept coming up time and time again, that the sooner you set out the National A season, the sooner everyone can sort of begin to plan around that. The teams can begin to plan. They need to also look at international race programs for the Conti teams. So you need to try and, to some degree, plan the A series around what's happening on the continent, wherever you can. Of course, it's a very difficult job to do, Tim, because it's almost impossible at times, because of course a course opens up only on a particular date because of road closures, whatever it might be. So you've got no option but to run the race, a National A race then. And it might conflict with a Conti team wanting to travel abroad to a UCI race, for example. So you've got to try and work that out. And then you've got all the National B organisers sitting beneath that going, okay, well, we want to sort our races out too. So it's like a big Jenga puzzle that sort of needs to somehow get set. It's not easy. And you know, one of the things that we've continually come back to time and time and time again on this podcast is we're trying to plan in a period where everything's uncertain. The economy is uncertain. We've got the general election, which makes everything uncertain in for the councils. We've got the council elections, as we've talked about. We've got the economy not growing. We've got business startups fading. You know, there's lots going on, which makes it incredibly difficult to predict what's going to happen. And all of these things have trickle-down effects to things like race planning, because then, of course, you're relying on, as we talked about for the Women's Tour of Britain and the Tour of Britain, certain councils giving you the heads up many, many months out that they are in. But those same councils are faced with that same uncertainty that they don't know whether they're even going to be in seat anymore. And then they don't know what the funding envelope is going to be from the new government, if there is one. So all of these factors make planning very difficult. And I really understand Deb's point. I really do. I really feel for her and all those organisers just sort of sitting and waiting. But it's unfortunately the complicated nature of the entire process which is causing this effect for the organisers in the National Bees.
Almost a perfect storm at the moment, isn't it, Phil? I mean, we've got a depressed economy, elections looming both locally and nationally. A very difficult time for anyone to plan effectively, let alone for bike race organisers. But if you had to put your money on anybody, it would be Deb and Tobes, who do a wonderful job with Cold Dark North. And they're not alone. We've got a couple of cracking races coming up. Seb Otley, who dived in earlier this year to save the Perfs pedal race, renamed it the Portsdown Classic. You might remember Ed Clancy racing there earlier this year. Well, Seb's Fat Creations road race takes place in Goodwood this Saturday, March the 30th, with races for men and women, and the women's race will serve as the opening round of the British Women's Team Cup. The National Road Series resumes or starts, depending on whether you're competing in the women's or the open class, on Sunday, April the 14th, with the return of the East Cleveland Classic. Springfield is finally with us. Winter is dying away, and these races are coming thick and fast. Thank you very much again for joining me today, and thank you to everybody out there for listening.
If you've enjoyed today's episode, please hit subscribe.